Okay, if you would turn in your Bibles to Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. I'm going to read the whole chapter. It's just 14 verses. I'm going to go ahead and read the whole chapter to set the context, and then we'll go back and look at the role of government and the role of our being in a government or under a government and under a, in a nation, and how we're to respond to that. And it's kind of a review of what we already know, but it's probably good to focus in on some of the reasons and some of the things behind our subjection and submissiveness to government and government authorities. So let's begin in verse 1 of chapter 13, and we'll read the entire chapter. Let every person be in subjection to the government authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authorities? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good, but if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. Wherefore it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Love, therefore, is a fulfillment of the law. And this do, knowing the time that is already at the hour for you to awaken from sleep. For now, salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. The night is almost gone, and the day is at hand. Let us therefore lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lust. Okay, so it's a good timely subject to talk about the government, because we're living in a day when the government that we live under is seemingly falling apart in so many ways, going contrary to what we are used to, what we are accustomed to, what we have held to from the founding of our nation. Now, in talking about governments being the servants of God and that God has ordained every authority, that does not in any way say that there are not ever bad governments. And they're not ever evil people ruling people and causing people tremendous strife. And it's not saying that every government is doing what's good, okay? But God has ordained every government, and that's the point. And to begin, just to get the idea of understanding the principle and the reason for government, go back to Genesis. If you'll remember, the time between the fall of Adam and the flood, there were no governments. Okay, there were no governments during that time. And so right before the flood, the complete evil in all of the land was everywhere. In fact, if you read that verse in chapter 6 of Genesis, verse 5, it says, "Then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." And so what you had was, after the fall of Adam, you had a society that evolved out of that, where everyone did what they thought was good in his own eyes. And being evil in their heart, that turned out to be mostly evil. And if God had not chosen a lineage that flowed through Shem all the way down to Noah of righteous, godly men, the whole world would have been that way. And we know it's that way because when he brought the judgment of the flood, how many people were righteous in the whole world? Eight. Everybody else was in this category of evil, doing what was evil and having no restraint whatsoever. So after the flood, in Genesis chapter 10, he institutes this idea of government. In fact, he says in Genesis chapter 9, when he says, In verse 5, it says, surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast. I will require it from every man, from every man's brother. I will require the life of man. In other words, if you kill someone, you're going to be held accountable. Now, who's going to hold you accountable? That's the whole part. Who's going to hold you accountable? So God instituted governments and nations. And so in verse 32 of chapter 10, he said, these are the families of the sons of Noah according to their genealogies by their nations, and out of these the nations were separated on the earth after the flood. Now God used the time at the Tower of Babel. Now what was going on at the Tower of Babel?
Pride. A big group.
Everybody came together. It was one people coming together to worship Satan, basically. It was Satan's intent to build a monument to himself, that he was the god of this world, that he's controlling this world, and all these people were gathering together to basically follow the as the sons of unrighteous, the sons of Satan, to follow into that pattern of a one-world system, a one-world government, and all of them were going to do according to what was good for the whole group. And so it was going to be one government. And God said, this is not good. And so he broke them up by genealogies, by nations, by language groups, into different nations. So nationalities began after the flood, and then governments were imposed to control the wickedness and the wicked actions. You're not going to control the hearts of people. Therefore, you need a government to control the actions of people that have evil hearts. And so basically, governments were imposed to control the actions of people who are evil in their heart. You're not going to change the heart without a work of God, right? It's only the Spirit of God that can change the heart, and therefore you had to have some kind of mechanism in place to control the actions. Because when you look at most societies and most governments, they have one thing in common. They want to, in some way, control evil actions or actions that are a detriment to the entire society. That's why,
whether it's a Christian nation or not,
no matter what,
they'll do the same.
Exactly. No matter what kind of government, what kind of nation it is in the best interest of the society and the government that's over the society for people not to be killing each other, for people not to be just rampantly doing things that are harmful for the entire society. And so the governments are put in place basically for good. Not good in godly sense, but good in the sense that it's good for people to not be living in a society that has complete breakdown of all evil actions. And so governments were imposed for that reason, okay? So God has established governments, and he has established it for that purpose and that reason. Now, the other aspect that we're going to talk about why we submit to government authorities, is the understanding that God is orchestrating and controlling every government on earth. He has brought everyone to power. Look in Daniel. Daniel, in chapter 2, he has revealed this dream of Nebuchadnezzar's, and Daniel makes a proclamation after he has had this time with God revealing the vision of Nebuchadnezzar to him. In Daniel chapter 2, beginning in verse 20, Daniel answered and said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. It is he who reveals the profound and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness and the light that dwells with him. O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. So Daniel is praising God for giving him the understanding of the king's dream, but in his praise of God, he acknowledges that God is sovereignly in charge of every person that is brought into power and authority in any nation. Okay? So God is sovereign in all the affairs of mankind that are on earth. He is sovereign. Now, the angel that comes to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4, the angel that comes to Nebuchadnezzar makes this proclamation again when he's giving this vision and he's speaking to Nebuchadnezzar about what is to happen. He says, and we won't read the whole thing, he gives him a vision that's going to happen to Nebuchadnezzar, that he's going to be dethroned and he's going to become crazy, insane, and Nebuchadnezzar is given this vision by the angel, and then he goes to Daniel for the interpretation of the dream. But in the vision he gets from the angel says to him, in verse 17 of Daniel chapter 4, "This sentence is by the decree of the angelic watchers, and the decision is a command of the holy ones, in order that the living may know that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whom he wishes, and sets over it the lowliest of men." So he's talking about Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was the king of Babylon. He was the first of the four kingdoms that God has ordained to control Israel and the world. Okay? Nebuchadnezzar was the first. He's the head of gold. And he has elevated himself to think that he is the head of gold. He is somebody, and he is imposing his will because he is who he is. He is his own God. He's his own man. He's in control of everything. And the angel said, "This is going to happen to you so that you may understand and know that it is God who gives you the authority to be the king that you are." And so what happens to Nebuchadnezzar? He becomes insane. And he goes out and lives like a wild animal. And he is dethroned from his place. And then when he comes back to the end of that period, in chapter 4, verse 34, it says, "But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High and praise and honor him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. No one can ward off his hand or say to him, 'Why hast thou done this?'" So again, Nebuchadnezzar comes to his senses. He comes to realize and understand that he is a mere man and God is in control of everything on earth. So every authority and every government is under the authority and the sovereignty of God himself. Okay? So, John chapter, Jesus makes this statement. It's in John chapter 15. When he is appearing before Pilate, he makes a statement about Pilate's authority, because Pilate, again, is saying, "Do you not know I have the authority to put you to death?" And I've got the wrong verse, the wrong chapter. It is chapter 19, John chapter 19, verse 11. So Pilate is, in verse 10, Pilate therefore said to him, "You do not speak to me. Do you not know that I have authority to release you and I have authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me unless it had been given you from above." So again, Pilate is being the king, the governor, the ruler. He says, "Do you not know that I got power to have you crucified?" And Jesus says, "You have no authority, you have no power other than what has been granted you from above." And again, God is the one who grants authority and grants privilege and all that. He's in control of all the nations. Now, there is a problem in our understanding of that, in the fact that Satan is the god of this world. So how can you have God as sovereign over everything and Satan be the god of this world? Look in chapter 4 of Luke. Jesus has been pronounced as the Son of God by John the Baptist, and immediately he is led by the Spirit in the wilderness to be tested by Satan. Why was Jesus tested by Satan? Anybody ever thought through why he was being tested by Satan?
He wasn't sure Jesus' role.
That's true. What happened when God created the first Adam? Satan approached him. Satan approached him and said, are you going to obey a God or are you going to listen to me? And Adam listened to Satan. Okay? So the second Adam comes as a representative of humanity. And so Satan immediately goes to test him and say, "Are you too going to submit to me?" Now the second Adam was different than the first Adam, and the second Adam was God, who could not sin and had the power to overcome Satan. And so, but still, the same test, basically. Because here you had the first Adam was created by God and given dominion of the earth, and Satan comes to test him, and Adam falls. And so the second Adam now is being tested by Satan to see if he is going to follow in like suit of the first Adam. And so anyway, you get down there to verse 5, and Satan leads him up, leads Jesus up and shows him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. Now see, all the kingdoms of the world is basically the dominion of the earth that has been broken up into kingdoms. When Adam was first given the dominion, there was no kingdoms. There was no nations. It was just Adam, and he was given dominion over the whole earth to rule the earth. When he fell, that dominion went away. And who got the dominion? Satan. It says here, he led him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time, and the devil said to him, I will give you all this domain. Now, that domain is the domain of the earth, the dominion of the earth that Adam had, that he lost, and Satan usurped that dominion. Again, all dominion is under the sovereign hand of God. But God had given that dominion to Adam, and Adam gave it up by following Satan and listening to Satan. So Satan says, I will give you all this domain and its glory, for it has been handed over to me, and I give it to whomever I wish. Satan says, I've got dominion over this earth, and I give it to whomever I wish. Now, is that true? Yes. It's true because God has allowed that. Okay? God has allowed him to have dominion that serves God's eternal purpose. Right? But Satan does have dominion. He does have authority that God has ordained and allowed to do certain things on the earth that will fulfill God's purpose. But again, it's all under the subjection of God. Remember the deal with Job. Satan has dominion over the earth, over the whole thing, but he couldn't touch Job because God said no. And then God had to allow him to have an impact on Job's life because God was keeping that aspect of the dominion of the earth away from Satan until he gave him that dominion. So Satan does have dominion. He does have authority that was given to him because of Adam's fall, but it is not supreme authority. It is not supreme dominion. It is still under the dominion of God. Okay, but he has dominion, and he says, I can give you this. Now, what he was saying to Jesus is, if you will bow down and worship me, you can have the dominion of the earth back. I will give it to you without you having to go to the cross and suffer as the second agent or the second representative of mankind to bring them to a righteous state. In other words, if you will become unrighteous, you can have the world, but everybody's going to be doomed forever if you do that. Okay? So,
did he really think he'd give in?
He didn't know, that's why.
He didn't know because he is fallen and he doesn't grasp the fact that other people could not be swayed to be evil like he is.
But he had seen the power of God.
It doesn't matter. Once you're in darkness, the darkness takes over your thinking. Why do you think he keeps fighting all the way to the end, knowing that God is going to come and destroy everything, but he still thinks there's a chance that it can happen? He will fight all the way to the end.
Revelation talks about him knowing his end is coming.
Okay, so in light of that, let's look back at a couple of instances in the Old Testament that kind of give us an insight to that. First, look in Isaiah chapter 14. And this is the insight into the realm of the kingdoms of the earth under the control of Satan. So in Isaiah 14, Isaiah is commissioned to take up a judgment or a prophecy against the king of Babylon. He says in verse 4, he says, that you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased, how the fury has ceased, the Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers. And so he's talking about the kingdom of Babylon, or the king of Babylon. And then he goes on down and he continues in this, and he says in verse 11, your pomp and music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth, you who weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recess of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. That is a reference to the mindset of Satan. So the king of Babylon is under the mindset and the control of Satan. So he's talking to the king of Babylon, but in reality, he's talking to the king behind the king of Babylon, which is Satan. Another passage in Ezekiel that we refer to, that we, and the reason I'm using these passages is because Satan is purposely injected into the conversation. So in chapter 28 of Ezekiel, the same thing is true. It says in verse 1, the word of the Lord came again to me, saying, Son of man, say to the leader of Tyre, or the prince of Tyre, thus says the Lord God. And he says, because your heart is lifted up, and you have said, I am a God. So he's not speaking directly to Satan here. He's talking to the king of Tyre. It's just like King Herod. When King Herod was being praised, you're a God, and he took that in. He said, people think I'm a God? I must be a God. And immediately worms started eating his body, and he died. Because God said, you're not going to do that. You're not going to let people worship you as a God, and you acknowledge that you are that God. I'm not going to give you that. So he killed Herod. Same thing here is the king of Tyre has looked at his kingdom and says, I'm like a God. So he goes on down there to verse 11, and it says, again, the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, take up a lamentation over the king of Tyre. Now, the first verse, he says, the prince of Tyre, or the leader of Tyre, the ruler of Tyre, and now he's talking to the real king of Tyre. And he goes on, he says, thus says the Lord God, you had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Your precious stone was your covering, the ruby, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, and so forth. The gold, the workmanship of your settings and sockets was in you. On the day that you were created, they were perfect. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. So the real king of Tyre is who? Satan, the one who was the anointed cherub, who elevated himself to be like God. In his pride, he was filled with iniquity, and he became desiring to be elevated to the status of God. And so all those kings under Satan do the same thing. They want to be worshipped. They want to be praised. They want to feel like that they are in control, have the power themselves. So again, the leader of Tyre, the earthly ruler of Tyre, is under the subjection of the real king of Tyre, Satan, the god of this world. So every king in this world is in some way influenced by Satan, unless God himself has risen up a king like David, has risen up a king to be his representative on earth. Now, Israel was a nation under God, and so the kings of Israel were reporting directly to God. Does that mean all the kings of Israel were godly? No, they became agents of Satan to try to undermine what God was doing. But God had a plan and a purpose that he was going to elevate a king that was going to come out of Israel to be the ruler of the world eventually from God, that was going to take back the dominion that Adam lost. And so Jesus Christ, the son of Adam, the son of David, is going to be a king that's going to come back and restore the dominion that God had given to Adam that had been lost. And the second Adam is going to come back as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords and going to destroy the kingdoms of Satan and elevate the kingdom of God on earth again. Okay, so that's where all this is headed, is the fulfillment of everything that God said that's going to be fulfilled through Jesus Christ, the second Adam and the son of David. The second Adam is going to be the second man that's going to not fall, that's going to have dominion, and the son of David, which is going to be the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords of the kingdom of God that's going to be fulfilling the whole earth. If you remember in Daniel, the whole prophecy about the four kingdoms that were going to rise up, starting with Babylon and ending with the Antichrist. When Christ comes back to the earth, he destroys that kingdom that is at that time ruled by the Antichrist. And let's just look at that real quick in Revelation 13. Because again, it speaks to the fact that God has given this authority temporarily to Satan and to Satan's dominion and to Satan's king. So in Revelation 13, you have the rising up of the Antichrist, the fact that he's killed and then risen back up from the dead by Satan, and he is elevated to the place of dictator of the whole earth. It says in verse 3 of chapter 13, "And I saw one of his heads as it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed, and the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast." The beast is the Antichrist, the last ruler of the times of Gentiles, the last ruler of the fourth kingdom, which was started with the kingdom of the Roman Empire and will end with the kingdom that controls the whole world, that is an extension of the Roman Empire, and the Antichrist is the last ruler of that kingdom. It says, "They followed after the beast, and they worshiped the dragon because he had given his authority to the beast." The authority that Satan had been given is now given to the Antichrist. "And they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast, who is able to wage war with him?' And there was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him." So God has given to the Antichrist, as the ruler of Satan, the authority to rule the earth for the last 3.5 years of the tribulation, and it will be a total dictatorship, a total authority, but people will still rebel against that authority. But he has the authority to rule the earth and dictate to the earth what is going to happen during that last 3.5 years.
And is that the same dominion that he was offering Jesus? I mean, is it the same type of authority?
Yes, it's the same dominion, because it's the dominion of the earth. It has just been elevated to the point where Satan now, in the last 3.5 years, you have the unholy trinity given full authority to act as the unholy trinity on earth. That's why the rising up of the false prophet and the Antichrist, and they're all under Satan's direct control, because he has been cast down to the earth for the last 3.5 years. He is on the earth as the unholy trinity. He's acting as God the Father. The Antichrist is acting as the Son, and the false prophet is acting as the Spirit, all in a anti-Christ fashion, or anti-God fashion. But this is the unholy trinity that is superimposing its will upon the dominion that's been allowed, that have been allowed to have for the last 3.5 years. It's going to be the final, the last woe that's talked about in Revelation chapters 9. The last woe is the woe of the total dominion of the unholy trinity upon the earth. The evil that flows out of the demonic dominion of Satan and his kingdom. It says, "And he opened his mouth to blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is those who dwell in heaven. And it was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of the life of the Lamb." So everyone in the world will worship him except those who have been chosen of God before the foundation of the world. They will not take the mark of the beast. They will not worship him. Most of them will be killed, but they will not give worship to the Antichrist and to Satan. But if you haven't been chosen before the foundation of the world, you will. So that last 3.5 years, the majority of the people are going to take the mark of the beast and worship the Antichrist, worship Satan, and this is the final authority. But this authority has been granted them for this time period. Make no mistake about it. The people of God will be killed during this time period, because authority has been given over to the Antichrist during this time for God's final part of the judgment against Israel and against the people of God is going to be carried out until they cry out for Jesus to save them, and he will come back and destroy the Antichrist and set up his kingdom. But this authority still has been granted to Satan. Now, so that what I'm saying is, even though kings and rulers have authority, doesn't mean they're necessarily good and godly just because they have authority. But for the most part, the principle is every nation and every kingdom is there for the benefit of the society that you live in, for the most part. Because even kings that are not God-fearing, Bible-believing kings still want to have order and some kind of control over the evil actions of people. That's the point he's making in Romans chapter 13. Okay, so let's go back to Romans 13. That's just kind of to set the background on this whole idea of authority and kingdoms and rulers that are all given their authority by God. It says in verse 1 of chapter 13 again, "There is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God." So that means Joe Biden is president because God has established Joe Biden to be president. That doesn't mean you have to like Joe Biden or like his policy and like his mindset toward anti-God stuff, but God has established him as president for a purpose. If that purpose is to judge America for its sins and its going away from the things of God, then God is going to use that.
There's a question I've got too there. With the way our system of government is set up in this country, not everywhere else, just in this country, we have the right and obligation at times to confront our government.
You're getting ahead of me. Hold on. Hold on just a minute. We're going to go there. You're getting ahead of me just a little bit on that, okay? Before we go there, let's focus in first on the command, okay? The command is, let every person be in subjection to the government authorities, okay? So the command is for believers in whatever nation they're in to be subject to the government authorities. Again, there are boundaries to that submission and to that subjection. You can't go against God to obey man, right? That's established all the way through. You can't violate what God said for you to do just because the government says that you must do that. You can't do that. But when it doesn't violate what God said, you're supposed to submit and be a submissive citizen of the government that you live in. Generally obeying the laws of the government, okay? That's what he says. Now, there's Paul says this in several passages. Look in 1 Timothy chapter 2. He says in verse 1 of 1 Timothy chapter 2, "First of all, then I urge that entreaties and prayers and petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men for kings and all who are in authority." Okay, so as a citizen of a government or a citizen of a country, there is leadership over you that God has put in authority, and he says you are to pray for that leadership. Okay? So we're to pray for those who are in authority over you. You're to be understanding that you are to submit to that. And it says, in order that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. So what he's saying is, don't buck against the government to cause them to bring wrath upon you when there's no reason for you to do that. In other words, if you have no godly reason to reject or to resist the government authorities, if there's no godly reason, then submit to the government authorities that they won't come against you and put you in prison or put you in jail or take your stuff away or whatever they're going to do because you are resisting the government. In other words, pray for them that you will be allowed to live a quiet and tranquil, peaceful life. In other words, you don't want to be fighting against the government without reason to fight against the government. That's what he's saying. Pray for them that they'll leave you alone and you'll be able to go about your business in a way that you will be able to live your life in a quiet way. But he says that they have been put in authority over you, and so pray for them and obey them in that standpoint. All right, look in Titus chapter 3, verse 1. Paul is saying to the church and to the elders of the church, remind them, the church members, that they are to be in subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed, to malign no one, to be uncontentious, gentle, showing every consideration for all men. Okay, so then he says, for we also once were foolish ourselves, disobedient, deceived, enslaved to various lusts. What is the mindset of most unbelievers in their response to those in authority over them? Can't tell me what to do. It's that mindset of unbelievers that are always in unsubmissive response to anyone that has authority over you. That goes against that nature of man that came from Adam, is I don't want anyone to tell me what to do.
And this seems to be a theme that Paul presented to the people across
everywhere he went. Yeah.
Be submissive.
You are a servant of God, a bond slave to Jesus Christ. Therefore, he is saying, as a bond slave to Christ, be obedient, submissive in your outlook, in your demeanor toward those who have authority over you, as long as they don't make you do something that is contrary to what you are committed to as a bond slave of Christ. You can't let the government say you can't be a bond slave to Christ. But as a bondslave of Christ, you must be a subservient to what Christ has said to do in response to governments. You've got to have a mindset and attitude that is not rebellious and arrogant and mean-spirited and not wanting to submit in any way.
That's why governments consider us so dangerous, because we have a higher...
Exactly. Okay, but they shouldn't consider us dangerous in the standpoint as long as they don't interfere with our following Christ. We're not going to be a danger to you.
Right.
I mean, Christians should not be a danger to a government that is not trying to take away your Christianity. They should be the most... Government should be the most respectful and liking of Christian people than any other people there, because Christian people should not be the ones that's going to try to overthrow their government. But that's what but that's not the case. And why is that not the case? No, it's because Satan hates God and hates God's people. And so even though Christians are the best citizens that you could have in your government, because they're not going to be doing things to cause turmoil in your society, the government tends to hate Christians because the governments tend to be controlled by Satan. And Satan hates the people of God. Just like in our country. You would think that the agenda of government would be to promote a society that is the best for all people.
A moral society
is the best for all things. But what do they promote? Everything is immoral. The government wants to impose everything that is against God. The homosexual agenda, every aspect of taking God out of everything, doing away with any kind of standard of Judeo-Christian respect and morals and codes. They want to do away with all that, thinking that society's going to be better for that. Just from a practical, rational standpoint, you would think that anybody that's in control of government say, if we want a society that works best, then let's do what the Christians do. But they don't do that, because that would be acknowledging that God is right.
Paul, you see in this, though, where a lot of Christians today seem to take a lot of comfort in sitting back, and when they should speak up, they don't. And they hide behind this, and they don't analyze exactly when or at what point should we stand up as a unified body and say, wait a minute, we don't agree. We're not being violent.
You're jumping ahead, too. Oh. We're getting there. We're getting... Okay, we're getting there.
Well, it's 4 minutes till 10.
Okay. One last passage, 1 Peter chapter 2. I'm just wanting to show you that Paul and Peter both have given the same admonition. The mindset of believers is to be submissive to government. Okay, that's the mindset. That's what you start with. You start with, I want to be a good citizen. I want to be a servant of God, a bondslave of Christ. I want to do what is right and be obedient to Christ. Okay, so Peter says in verse 13 of chapter 2 of 1 Peter, he says, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake. Now here it is. You submit yourself for the Lord's sake. The Lord has given you this command, this direction. You are to submit to governments for His sake. Now, you can't just say, I'm going to do what I think is best. You're a bondslave. That's what Paul has said in chapter 12. Present your bodies a living sacrifice. You are a bondservant to Christ. You have died to yourself. You have presented your life on the altar as a sacrifice to God. Your life is not your own anymore. You're bought with a price. Therefore, you are to serve God. And so it's for the Lord's sake that he says, submit yourself to the governments. You're representing him. You're not your own person. You're a slave to Christ. So if you're a believer, you're a slave to Christ, and you've got to obey Christ. As a servant of His, He's asked you to be submissive to governments. Okay? So Peter goes on and says, submit yourself for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bondslaves of God. You are free because God has made you free in Christ. In other words, no government can force you to disobey God. You're free to obey God, but God has said in your freedom as a servant of mine, I exhort you, I implore you, I command you to be submissive to the government authorities over you. That means the king, the president, that means the governor, that means the local authorities. As long as they're not telling you to violate your servitude to God and you're following Jesus Christ, submit to the governments that are over you. The general principle is we submit.
Does that include the dog catcher?
I'm not sure about the dog catcher part.
Just wondering.
But I guess if he has been appointed by the governor, appointed by the local authorities, and there's a rule and law on how you're to keep your dogs, I guess you need to submit to that. Okay, now, subjection to government is obedience to God. The authorities have been established to contain evildoers. Most governments want order in society, and they have imposed laws that maintain that order and that control, so that society will normally be able to function against the backdrop of evilness. Now, in Afghanistan, we see what happens when there is no government control. And you can't call what is going on with supposedly Taliban as a government control. That is like having thugs run the streets and do whatever they... That's more like it was before the days of Noah. I mean, before Noah's time. These are just running rampant, doing whatever they decide that they're going to do. And so you see true evil in what's going on over there. Now, Paul and Daniel are two examples, I think, of what we should do. First, Daniel. Daniel was displaced as a Jew, as a Hebrew, to Babylon. He served under at least three or four different kings in Babylon. And every king he served under, he was very submissive to that king, very respectful of that king. And he was elevated by God to positions of authority in the kingdom. He never wavered in his commitment to God, but he also never wavered in his obedience and submissiveness to the king over him. Right? When he was thrown in the lion's den, he acknowledged that the king had every right to do that. Okay? And so, in every way, he never wavered from his commitment to God, but he was also never wavering in his respect and his submissiveness to the king that God had placed him under. Okay, so that's the Daniel is a good example of how you live out that reality. Now, Paul, it was interesting on Paul's just a couple things on Paul's looking at Acts 16. Remember when Paul was put in prison and they beat him? The Roman authorities were always taking the route of least resistance or whatever. And so if the Jews were kind of the ones in charge of the city and they had a lot of sway with the prominent people of the city, then the Roman commanders that were in charge of the city would kind of go along with them. And so they had Paul imprisoned and beaten. And so then in verse 36 of chapter 16 in Acts, it says, "And the jailer reported these words to Paul, saying, 'The chief magistrates have sent to release you. Now, therefore, come out and go in peace.'" So the chief magistrates are servants of Rome. They're part of the government. And so Paul said to them, "They have beaten us in public without trial, men who are Romans." Paul has established the fact that he has rights as a Roman citizen. And these Roman authorities have beaten him contrary to the law of the Roman government. So Paul says, "They have beaten us in public without trial, men who are Romans, and have thrown us into prison. Now are they sending us away secretly? No, indeed. But let them come themselves and bring us out." And the policemen reported these words to the chief magistrates, and they were afraid when they heard that they were Romans. Paul had rights as a Roman citizen. And as citizens of the United States, we have rights. And so you can function as long as you have rights as this country. In this country, you can appeal to government authorities in the area that you have a right as a citizen. You can't treat me this way. I have rights. So you have a constitution. You have the things that you can appeal to, and you have every right to do that. As a citizen, you can stand up for your rights. Okay, that's part of the government. The government has a document. As long as we have a document and a government that's supposed to to hold to that document and that standard of government, you have a right as a citizen to appeal to that. You can't treat me this way because I am a citizen of the United States of America and I have rights as a citizen. Now, if they change the government, they throw away the Constitution and they impose another government that doesn't give you those rights, then you can't do that. But as long as you have a citizen of this country, you have rights, okay? So Paul makes that clear that he had rights as a Roman citizen and they were violating his rights. And so they came and appealed to them when they had brought them out, and then they kept begging them to leave the city. In other words, leave our jurisdiction. We've messed up. You're a Roman citizen. We don't want to be held accountable to that.
This is really important, what's going on today. The idea of nation building in certain countries is just stupid, because without Christian background, citizens aren't going to have rights. You know, and it's not going to happen. And so this is the influence of God making republics, democratic republics, but we can't make them unless there's citizens willing to obey them.
No. So again, we're strangers in this world. We're not to be about trying to establish kingdoms on earth. God will do that. We're supposed to submit to those kingdoms under his leadership. Following Paul in this understanding of his citizenship of Rome, though, is in Acts 22, what happened, he's back in Jerusalem, and the Jews are trying to put him to death. They're trying to kill him, okay? And so he says in verse 22 of Acts 22, and they listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voice and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." And as they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust in the air, the commander of the Romans ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. So they were going to bring him in and beat him until they could find out what was going on. And when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, "Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?" See, the Roman authorities there, they were trying to appease the Jewish mob, and they were going to beat Paul. And so Paul says, "Wait a minute, is it lawful for you to do this? I'm a Roman citizen." And when the centurion heard this in verse 26, he went to the commander and told him, saying, "What are you about to do? For this man is a Roman." And the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." And the commander answered, I acquired this citizenship with a large sum of money." And Paul said, "But I was actually born a citizen. I am a citizen of Rome, born as a citizen of Rome. I have legal rights. You can't treat me, according to Roman law, you can't treat me the way you're trying to treat me." So again, Paul appealed as a Roman citizen, "You can't do this. It's not according to Roman law. I'm a citizen and I have rights. You can't do it."
They seem to fear their law and breaking it more than we do today.
Well, they feared the consequences of them doing something that their next in command was going to, they're going to create something that they're going to be held accountable. Exactly.
Applied to us in our rejection and standing on constitutional rights, but I'm afraid that's a road.
Then he goes on and says, "Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him, and the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had put him in chains." So they understood the consequences of you violating the law of Rome was more important to them than what Paul was doing. And then one other thing there about Paul in Acts 25, he'd been brought before Festus, and again, the accusers were accusing him of charges. Paul says in verse 17, or they say in verse 17, "So after they had assembled here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal in order that the man be brought." This is Festus. "And when the accusers stood up, they began bringing charges against him, not of such crimes as I was expecting, but they simply had some points of disagreement with him about their own religion." So Festus had been told that he was worthy of being killed, put to death. And then he starts to examine this, and all the charges against him were religious charges. They weren't like he violated any laws. They were just religious charges that they hated him for. And so then it says in verse 20, "And being at a loss how to investigate such a matter, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there stand trial on these matters. But when Paul appealed appealed to be held in custody for the emperor's decision. I ordered him to be kept in custody until I send him to Caesar. And Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. And then, Paul appealed for them to hear, to go before Caesar. And since he was appealed for that, then he had the right to go to Rome and not be held in Jerusalem, and had rights for that. So, again, in verse 10 of chapter 25, it says, Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you also very well know. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of these things is true of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. So again, Paul says, these men are making up charges against me. They're not true. If I have done anything to violate the law of the land, that is the Roman law, even though they were in Jerusalem, the Romans were in charge. He said, I am willing to die. If not, don't hand me over to this kangaroo court. I appeal to Caesar. In other words, I'm a citizen of Rome. I appeal. I have the right to appeal, and I want to go to Rome and have my trial heard in Rome.